Let's see whether we can finish this chapter up. I mentioned what we're looking at on slide 8, but we haven't looked at this slide yet. At least I mentioned part of it. I talked about the fact that some transporters are called co-transporters, which this book calls coupled transporters. That simply means that there are two different kind of particles moving more or less simultaneously. And that's all that means. So that's why there are two different kinds of co-transporters, symporters and antiporters. Or they can just be called symport and antiport as well. Although symport and antiport also refers to the actual process of them moving. Anyway, the difference, as we already discussed, is sim means together. So symporters move two different particles in the same direction. Not necessarily into the cell, they could both be moving out, but it's the same direction as each other. Whereas antiporters move two different particles in opposite directions. One will move in and one will move out. On the other hand, a more run-of-the-mill transport protein operates for a uniport, which means movement of just a single type of solute. So the uni doesn't mean one particle is going to be moved. For instance, these things are used over and over, of course. So it's co-transporter only if it's different kinds of particles. I think you understood that already, though. So let's go on to 9 and look at an example of a transport protein, but what classification of transport protein is this? You can see that glucose is the thing that's being moved. Yes, this is a carrier protein as opposed to a channel, right? And you know it's a carrier protein for what reason? Right, not only is there temporary binding, but what else is the hallmark of a carrier protein? No, I'm glad you said that, because carrier proteins can be used for either passive or active transport. Right, the hallmark of a carrier protein is that its function involves conformational change. It won't work unless it changes shape. And what is it that causes the shape change? The temporary binding of the ligand, which in this case is the thing that's being transported through the membrane by that carrier protein. And so in this case, glucose is the permeating substance. It's being transported through this glucose transporter. And is this active or passive transport? This is passive. You can't really appreciate from this simple cartoon that there is a higher concentration of glucose outside the cell than inside. But there is. And that's the only reason, of course, that glucose is going inward in this case, right? When you're talking about passive transport of any solute, the direction of that transport is solely determined by the direction of the concentration gradient for it. Or I should say, more specifically, the electrochemical gradient, which is partly concentration and partly due to charge. We'll talk more about that later. By the way, I'll leave that for later. Let's go on to 10. These are cartoons of a porin protein. Now, porin is a general word. There are different kinds of porins. I think we already encountered an aquaporin as an example last time, I think. Porins get their name because they form pores. So porins are examples of channel proteins. And this ribbon model with the arrows representing what? Not alpha helices. Beta pleated sheets, right. This is one way to build a channel. Now, channels can also be built using alpha helices. This one, porins, are using these beta-pleated sheets. But the reason that it's a porin is because this forms basically a tunnel. And the wall of this tunnel, which is the beta sheets of the protein itself, those are what shield whatever is permeating through the membrane from the hydrophobic tails of the phospholipids that would be surrounding this thing. Because remember, this is embedded in a protein, in a membrane. All right, so it just forms a little tunnel through the membrane, which is open, assuming there's no gate on it that's closed at the time. And even though it's an open space, that does not mean that just anything can get through it. Of course, anything too big wouldn't get through it, for obvious reasons. But also, there's a little bit more specificity than just the size. Because there is a little bit of interaction between what is permeating the solute and the walls of the porin. So, even channel, of course, carrier proteins are specific, right? For a certain type of thing to go through them. But even channel proteins are specific, at least to a certain degree. For instance, there can be a channel that will only allow negative ions through it. But there can even be channels that will allow only a certain kind of negative ion through it. So they can have specificity even though they're really just tunnels. Well, 11 is another example of a porin. This one is aquaporin, and we saw a different version of this in a previous slide last meeting. This is just showing you the detail of the protein itself. And notice it's a tetramer. Now, what kind of tetramer is it specifically? Right, it's a homotetramer. Why? Right, all of the constituent polypeptides are identical. It's a tetramer because there's four of them. But it doesn't actually... these have to come together for it to function, have the right shape to function in the membrane. Notice, though, that in this case, these four polypeptides don't form one opening between them all. That middle is filled by a lipid molecule, actually, that stabilizes it. Instead, each individual polypeptide has a channel through it. So this single aquaporin is actually four tunnels in one. And of course it's called an aquaporin because it's specific for water molecules. Now water slips through the phospholipid bilayer to a certain extent, even though you would expect it not to, right? Because it's a polar molecule. Well, this is in keeping with what I said before. The phospholipid bilayer isn't a perfect barrier to things that shouldn't get through it. But it means that in any given cell, water leakage through the phospholipid isn't all that great, especially if you actually want the water to flow quickly through the membrane. That's why you would open up or incorporate into the membrane an aquaporin. This is how cells, for instance, of the kidney, in making the final decision as to how dilute or concentrated the urine should be, adjusts that. They can embed aquaporins into the membrane or take them out of the membrane, depending on whether they want that water to be left in the urine, keeping it dilute, or let the water come back into the blood, keeping the urine concentrated. It's just one example of an aquaporin. But aquaporins are water channels. So what you see on the right here is flow of water through just one of the monomers. It's happening at four different places in that same aquaporin because it's a tetramer. Now, in 12, we're going to focus on active transport. And what we see in A, difference in between A and B, is what a lot of people, including me, call either primary active transport or secondary active transport. This book chooses direct and indirect active transport as the terminology. But probably more textbooks use the other terminology, primary active transport and secondary active transport. And by the way, usually unless we're making a comparison, we don't even bother with the word primary. If we just talk about active transport, that usually means direct or primary active transport. And what makes it active, of course, is that there is expenditure of additional energy. There is not enough built-in energy in the system to drive the flow of whatever that solute is, because active transport moves things against their gradient, right? Which increases the instability. Things tend toward stability on their own. They, in other words, decrease the value of G, right? That's how things become stable. Well, active transport reverses that process, so you have to supply energy for this to happen at all. And what kind of transport protein is required for this? A carrier. Because if you just open up a channel, of course, there's going to be flow in the opposite direction, down the gradient. It would work against you. You have to actively grab on to the thing that you're forcing to the other side, even though on that other side there's already a lot of that stuff. So an active transporter, like I said before, is a pump. When you hear that word pump applied to a transport protein, you know that you're talking about active transport. And so pumps operate by taking something that is already comparatively rare in one place, taking it out of that place and putting it into something where it's already has a high concentration. Well, if you just pay attention to the left protein in this figure, that by itself is operating via active transport or primary active transport. And it's called primary active transport because that additional expenditure of energy is spent right there at that protein. Now, in this case, what drives the active transport, the energy source in other words, is the hydrolysis of ATP, adenosine triphosphate. That's why you see ATP being broken down into ADP and inorganic phosphate. The breaking of that bond between the terminal phosphate and the second phosphate releases energy, some of which is put to use dragging, in this case, hydrogen ions from the interior of the cell to the exterior of the cell. All right, so that's active transport or primary active transport. What a primary active transport mechanism does, in other words, what a pump does, is create or establish and maintain a gradient with respect to that permeating substance. So in this case, this specifically is a proton pump, because a proton is the same thing as a hydrogen ion, right? H plus, hydrogen ion, proton should all mean the same thing in your mind. Well, we animals have certain proton pumps in our bodies. That's the main kind of pump that plants use. Not to say that there aren't anything but plants and animals, but those two big groups of organisms both use pumps, and so do effectively all non-animals use proton pumps primarily as their pumps. Now, why would you pump protons from one side of the cell to the other to establish a gradient? Well, it might be that you really want the protons to be on the other side of the membrane for whatever reason, and that's the end goal in a sense, but usually not. So active transport is often used to establish a gradient just for the sake of having that gradient as a source of potential energy. Never forget that a gradient is stored energy. It's a form of potential energy. All right, which is exactly why diffusion works on its own, because it's using that built-in potential energy that is the gradient. To produce a gradient requires energy for the opposite reason, as allowing a gradient to be dissipated, allowing diffusion to happen, releases energy. Okay? So usually what happens in a pump is that it's not really that you want that particular solute to be on the other side of the membrane. You just want to store energy in the form of a concentration gradient or an electrochemical gradient so that later on, so that that gradient can then do some work for you. And that is the distinction between primary and secondary active transport. On the right side, which this book, as I said, is calling indirect active transport, we have secondary active transport. So both of these proteins are working for active transport. In both cases, something is being moved against its gradient. In the direct case, or the primary case, the left one, it's protons that are being moved against their gradient. The right one, which is a totally different protein, even though it's the same lavender, that one is moving S. Which, does it say even what S stands for? No, it's just a general case. S for solute. It's moving it against its gradient. Notice there's a bunch of S's inside. So S would like to diffuse out of the cell if it were given a chance. Instead, this thing is dragging even more S into the cell. So it's moving S against its gradient and therefore is pumping S. But notice that there is no ATP being spent at that second protein. I should have mentioned when I talked about hydrolysis of ATP, by the way, that it's not always ATP that is the original source of energy. It often is, but it doesn't have to be. It has to be some source of energy, though, for the primary active transport. Okay, now back to this secondary active transport. S is being pumped. No ATP, though, is being used to drag S against its gradient. So what is the source of energy? The proton gradient is the source of energy. And that's really why you bother to have a pump to establish that proton gradient. You're taking energy that, for the moment, is stored in ATP, releasing that energy and storing some of that energy in a different form, in the form of a gradient, which the pump establishes. Then that gradient can do some work for you. This is analogous to putting in effort, spending energy, to drag buckets of water uphill, working against a gravitational gradient in that case, so that you can then pour those buckets of water over a water wheel, allowing this is analogous to the diffusion, right? Letting the water fall down its gravitational gradient is like diffusion. But if you pour it in the right place so that it hits the water wheel, that water wheel turns in response. That's the payoff. You use that gradient to do some work for you. And it's not that you just want to see the wheel turn. The wheel is connected to an axle that is connected to a millstone that will grind your corn. If that's, you could also just buy it at a store. But this is how it was done, right? So that's the analogy here. You spend energy to create a gradient just for the purpose of allowing that gradient to then do some work for you. It's just storing energy in a different form versus ATP. The reason ATP has its energy is because you took energy out of the food you ate to produce that ATP to begin with. So ATP is storing it first. Now it's storing it in the form of a gradient. So when we have secondary active transport, what we have is not only a transport protein, but a co-transporter, right? And in this case, specifically a symport protein, because both permeating solutes are moving in the same direction. They're both moving into the cell. So in this specific case, the only way that... let me just say that in this specific case, protons, because of the gradient that's established by the pump, the primary active transporter, they would like now to diffuse down their gradient. They're protons, though, fully charged ions, and therefore don't easily get through the phospholipid bilayer directly. So the only place that they are allowed back in, because remember, one of the requirements of diffusion is that there has to be a way to get from A to B, is through this carrier protein that allows for protons to come in. But the reason it's secondary active transport is because as that diffusion of hydrogen ion happens, S solutes get dragged along for the ride. So hydrogen ions are diffusing in the right. That's important, right? They're diffusing and therefore going down their gradient. That's a passive process from their viewpoint. But the shape change that causes in the transport protein, the right one, is such that it will drag S along for the ride against its gradient. So hydrogen ion diffusion is powering the active transport of S. And the reason it's called secondary active transport is because the original source of energy is, which is the ATP in this case, is not spent directly there at that protein. That protein is using a gradient source of energy that was established by the original expenditure of energy. Yeah?
On the secondary protein, how many hydrogens can go in at the same
time? That depends on the specific protein. This is just a general cartoon. And so there are all kinds of different proton symporters or antiporters even, because this could work in such a way that as hydrogen ions come in, something else gets dragged out.
Primary protein, or for primary transport.
Yeah.
Does it have to be hydrogen ions?
No. In fact, I kind of got sidetracked when I was talking about non-animals using primarily proton pumps. We use proton pumps to a certain degree as well, but the majority of our pumps for the purpose of doing cellular work are sodium-potassium pumps. Okay, so you don't find those so much in other organisms, but in animals, that's the main thing. And you have those, you have trillions of these pumps in your body because they're in all of your cells. Now, you learn about sodium-potassium exchange pumps usually first as when you in connection with nervous cells and muscle cells, which are definitely depend on those gradients of sodium and potassium. But all cells use them for a similar reason. By making those gradients can work for you in various ways. So in 13, we're looking at the sodium-potassium exchange pump. And what's represented here is really one pump, even though you see it in many different places. It's one pump in different configurations. So it's just a different snapshots through time. It's not to say that there's only one pump in the cell. There's hundreds of thousands of them on the one cell. But this is just showing you a single pump in its different conformations throughout the cycle of pumping. Now, it's self-explanatory why this thing is called the sodium-potassium pump. So it's highly specific. Only sodium and potassium get pumped by the sodium-potassium pump. And notice that they are both ions, and more specifically, they're both cations, right? Sodium and potassium are both positively charged. This is a pump. This is really two pumps in one, because unlike the proton S transporter that we just looked at, which was symport protein. Unlike that one, in which case one thing was diffusing and one was being actively transported. In the sodium-potassium exchange pump, both different kinds of solutes are being pumped. They're both being moved against their gradient. So, expenditure of energy is, of course, required by definition of active transport, and in this case, ATP is that source of energy. In the original configuration, which is at the top, notice that it's in a shape that has an inwardly facing binding site for sodium ions. But ATP is bound to it momentarily in that configuration. This allows sodium ions that happen to be inside the cell to bind temporarily to these sodium binding sites. And that, of course, is going to cause a conformational change. But it also causes hydrolysis of ATP. Okay, that's the expenditure of energy. It allows for the hydrolysis of ATP. ADP pops off, leaving the one phosphate behind, as you see here. All right, now that itself, well, that's the source of energy. That is going to cause a shape change that will allow the flipping of the open end of this protein toward the outside, which allows for these sodium ions to be released into the extracellular fluid, where they're already plentiful. Okay? So that leaves now the configuration you see at the bottom. Pump is open to the outside, still is phosphorylated. Once the sodiums leave, this allows for potassium ions from the extracellular fluid to bind. That's going to cause another shape change, including the popping off of the phosphate, and then the shape change that flips it so that the opening is toward the interior of the cell, which allows for the release of those potassiums into the intracellular fluid, where they are already plentiful. All right, and then once they leave, you're back to the original state, and this thing can operate once again as long as there's ATP available. Every single cycle of the pump requires another expenditure or hydrolysis of ATP. And this is why, since you have trillions of these things in your body working continuously for your lifetime, about 40% of your energy budget, the reason that you eat food, goes into just continuously operating these things. But that's the cycle. It just happens over and over. So notice that what's happening here is that because of the continuous operation of sodium-potassium pumps, the extracellular fluid always has a higher sodium ion concentration compared to the intracellular fluid, and the intracellular fluid always has a higher potassium ion concentration than the extracellular fluid, which means you have two separate gradients and therefore two separate sources of stored energy that are usable to the cell for various reasons. Because sodium is going to continuously want to diffuse back in but can't readily get through the membrane. So if there are proteins somewhere else that allow sodium to come in and drag something else along for the ride, you can use secondary active transport. Okay, the same thing is true for the gradient for potassium, except the direction of its gradient is reversed. Potassium continuously wants to leave the cell, but can't get through the membrane directly. Yeah?
So potassium and sodium, do they have the same amount of energy in the gradient?
Well, not exactly, no. Because for one thing, they're moved in different amounts. But also, they're used differently. These gradients are used differently. Sodium is used more often as a gradient for secondary active transport than potassium is. Well, speaking of using sodium as a sodium gradient as a way to secondarily actively transport something, that's what we have right here. This is another kind of glucose transporter. But in this case, glucose is not diffusing. It was in that original case. Original case was probably an erythrocyte, a red blood cell, glucose was going into the red blood cell simply because it was more plentiful outside the cell than inside the cell. Here you have a cell that is stockpiling glucose inside itself. So even though this cartoon doesn't show you, there's already a higher concentration of glucose inside the cell than outside. Therefore, to drag more in is going to take some energy. But you don't see any ATP being spent here on this slide, and that's because the ATP has already been spent on this same cell, even though it's not shown here, powering sodium-potassium exchange pumps. That's what establishes the sodium ion gradient. And so what this purple thing is here is a sodium ion glucose co-transporter. Now, is it a symporter or an antiporter? Sim, right. So this is exactly the same as the proton S transporter, the generic case that we looked at earlier, except that instead of using proton gradient, it's using a sodium ion gradient. But it's exactly the same otherwise, because you have inward diffusion of that ion that was pumped, and that diffusion is what's driving the active transport in the same direction inwardly of some other solute, in this case glucose. That all make sense? Well, if you shut down your sodium-potassium exchange pumps, this thing will continue to operate for a little bit. But every time this operates, that's going to dissipate the gradient a little bit. And if you're not continuing to pump sodium ions, eventually the gradient will come to zero. And there is no longer any tendency for sodium to come in more than to go out. And so it's no longer going to drag any glucose along for the ride. Glucose will be stuck outside. 15. Here we're looking at a membrane protein called bacteriorhodopsin. Oh, I thought it was spelled somewhere. Bacteriorhodopsin, which in this case is, ironically enough, in an archaean cell, not a bacterium. But anyway, bacteriorhodopsin is another example of a pump. But this is an example of a pump that uses some energy source other than ATP. Now, a lot of them do use ATP or some other nucleotide. Remember that ATP is a nucleotide, right? Well, other nucleotides are energy sources as well, like GTP, for instance. This isn't using a nucleotide, though. This is using light energy as the source. And this operates on the basis of a pigment called retinal. And I pronounce it that way rather than retinal, which means of the retina, because retinal is an aldehyde, ends in AL. And it exists in two conformations, cis and trans. So there are two shapes to it. Light, the energy of light being absorbed by retinal, changes its shape from cis to trans. And that causes a shape change in the protein that retinal is complexed with in this overall bacteriorhodopsin molecule. That shape change is such that it pulls protons from where they're already low concentration and drags them across to where they're already high concentration. So it works as a pump, exactly like the proton pump we looked at before, except the energy source is light instead of ATP. Once that is established, though, once that gradient is established, for exactly the same reason, that proton gradient is valuable to do cellular work for this archaean cell. If there are certain places where that proton is allowed to diffuse back in, it can drag things along for the ride, in other words, secondary active transport. And that's the chapter.